Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, some very personal memories of Blessed John the 23rd. We shine the spotlight on Saint Teresa of Avila and we bring you a musical comment on the second glorious mystery of the Rosary. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. On the 11th of October, the Church remembers Blessed John the 23rd.
John the 23rd is best remembered as good Pope John, the ordinary man who astonished the world. But while he has gone down in history books as the Pope who launched the Catholic Church into one of its most momentous epochs by calling the Second Vatican Council, it is the very human side to his personality that captured people's hearts and imaginations. People like those you'll be hearing on this programme, all of whom knew Pope John personally.
I remember when he was carried in the sedia gestatoria, and as a kind of joke he'd put his fingers in his ears like that and smile. They were making too much noise, I remember. And he thought they made too much noise.
L'aula massima del mondo cristiano è tutta pervasa del richiamo apostolico. Siamo tutti qui partecipi di questo vasto movimento della cristianità.
Because he had a very vibrant voice, although he was an old man, he spoke very fast. Perhaps because he was in a hurry. They said he was a man in a hurry, he had a lot to do. And also he used his hands a lot. More than most Italians. He didn't control his hands. He waved, he used them all the time, and he was smiling, and he communicated in every possible way with every part of himself, you know.
Ci sia lecito umilmente richiamare che in questo giorno esattamente l'umile successore di San Pietro, 40 anni or sono, chiamato dal Santo Padre Benedetto XV.
So he was walking up the stairs towards the main altar of St. Peter's, and as he went, he stumbled and fell. And I could hear the big sigh through the crowd. Most of them knew him from home. a fear, I guess. But he somehow scrambled up to his feet. I guess someone senior helped him up, but he got up on the top step and, you know, put his hands up in the sign of victory that he's still all right. And, you know, of course, the people all applauded, as you could expect, but he, with a big smile, then gave his talk.
Winston Churchill's first cousin, Sir John Leslie, was most struck by the Pope's sense of humour.
A great sense of humour. Monsignor Hemick, when he went around to the canons of St. Peter's, "Your Holiness, I'm just a poor American." He said, "Are there any?" She said, "No."
Chi verrà dopo di me più tardi, sempre, posso dire, sempre, questa Chiesa d'America è stata provveduta dal Signore di begli ingegni, di anime elette.
Rosminian father John Charles Leroux, who as the son of a former French ambassador to the Holy See grew up in Vatican circles, had a similar tale to tell.
It seemed that when he was elected Pope, the protocol is, what title are you going to give to your brothers or to your family? And his reply was, "Have you looked at them?" And of course they were not suitable to bear any title. They had remained very simple peasants. And another person, rather impertinent, had asked him, "Are you related to the Marquis of Roncalli?" They asked him, "There is a family of Marquis of Roncalli." And his reply was, "I am, my brothers are not."
Questo non è stampato, non è scritto.
What did that amuse me?
He said this last part is not printed.
Some of the bishops from Ohio found myself being the interpreter. And Pope John had a marvellous way with him, you see, making fun of himself, apologised, you see, for not being able to speak to them in English. These just little flashes of humour, flashes of, that established a relationship, a mood.
The founder of Boys Town, the late Monsignor Carol Abbing.
And he said he was delighted to meet the bishop from Ohio. So I, being knowing everything you see behind, said, Ohio. And so he went on, you see, and then he says, so next time, he said, we have dear friends coming to see him from Ohio. I said, Ohio. So he half turned to me and said, Ohio, Ohio. And I said, this is now when you keep quiet. You see, this is beautiful, beautiful spontaneity. And that was very much him.
And now a word of greeting to our beloved English-speaking children in the diocese of...
He was known here as, among the Americans as a Johnny Walker, because he loved walking and talking and meeting people and gesticulating and communicating and joking to you.
Former Prior General of the Augustinians, Father Martin Nolan.
We heard that he wandered off without announcing to anybody that he was descending for a walk in the garden. And whenever he went down there, he found nobody working. So that eventually he began to phone around, as what's happening, is nobody working in the Vatican. And they explained to him that Pius XII had wished that all the gardeners and others disappear when he took his daily walk. But John the 23rd, I heard, said, oh, no, sure, what's the point of taking a walk if you can't talk to somebody? So leave them there so that we can chat about this and that. And so in this way, the regime changed.
I remember one time, one of the universities, the first time the Pope went there, in our memory anyway, Pope Pius XII did not do that. He gave us a little peroration on how we should study hard to be good priests and to be good religious.
The late Carmelite Father Redemptorist Balabek.
The end of it, and he was trying to tell us how we have to be faithful to this church of ours that all of us love so much. And he was getting on, then he was getting toward the end of his talk, so he said, don't forget this church of ours that we have to love so much, this one holy, Catholic, and he couldn't think of the next word. And I could see all the Monsignor around him were embarrassed as anything. And he kept stuttering, and he couldn't get it. He said, well, let's say Roman. He forgot apostolic. That was Pope John. You know, it made all of us feel good, especially we who were up for exams. You know, if the Pope couldn't remember apostolic, gave us a lot of hope. And that's why we were big fans of Pope John the 23rd.
When he was appointed nuncio in Paris, I was in the Foreign Office by then. I'd been called back to the Foreign Office. And I remember one day, I found the car in front of the main door and suitcases everywhere, and the nuncio coming down the stairs. So he told me, oh, yes, you know, I've received a telegram from Rome asking me to go to come urgently to Rome. An obedient son of the church, as you see, I'm starting on the moment. But I'm not taking the aeroplane. In fact, one took very seldom the aeroplane still in those years, nor the night train. I'm taking my car. And as the nuncio must stop at every great cathedral that he sees and inspects what's happening there and so on, speaks to the bishop, I'll be in Rome in about 10 years' time. By that time, the problem would have been solved by somebody else.
Che da noi, ma insomma, si tratta sempre di un'energia vera a tutore della Chiesa Cattolica sulla quale si può contare.
I did go back to the Vatican while he was reigning during his pontificate. And he had developed, for instance, the court size. He had also taken up, in his own dressing, things that had disappeared. He dressed sometimes with that bonnet that you see on the portraits of Julius II by Raphael, and that had disappeared. He used the room of the Tronetto, which is a little throne room next to the office of the Pope, which Pius XII very rarely... I never saw Pius XII use that room, but he used it again. He sat on the throne and once for the private audiences of officials, not in his desk. He was on the throne, and there were two armchairs at the foot of the throne. And that's why when he received the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh, there was a display of the court that amazed all the English people. The Duke and the Queen came back absolutely thrilled by the display of that Renaissance court in its full splendour.
That same year, the late Lord Altrincham came out to Rome to report on the Queen's official visit to the Vatican, and also attended an audience with Pope John XXIII. I've asked my colleague, Philippa Hitchin, to read some extracts from this article for us.
Pope John XXIII makes even a general audience in St. Peter's seem like an intimate family occasion, a party thrown by a benign old man for the innumerable children who look for comfort, security, and guidance. Pope John has the demeanour of a good country priest, with bubbling zest and bonhomie, but no airs or graces. Born in the Sadia between thousands of applauding votaries, he responds to their enthusiasm in kind. They love him. He obviously loves them.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that programme, focusing on the figure of good Pope John, whose pontificate, by the way, lasted from 1958 to 1963. And now moving on in the broadcast, I'd like to remember someone from Spain whom the Church celebrates on the 15th of October. She's Saint Teresa of Jesus, more familiarly known as Teresa of Avila. Listen to this programme presented by Jill Bevilacqua.
Doña Teresa de Cepeda Ahumada was born in Avila, Spain, on March 28th, 1515. The child of well-born parents, she grew up in one of those palacios or mansions which can still be seen in Avila today. Later, Teresa used the image of these palaces to describe what she believed a contemplative convent should be, a fortress manned with a chosen company of the king's soldiers.
And in her masterpiece, Interior Castle, she wrote, "I began to think of the soul as if it were a castle made of a single diamond or a very clear crystal, in which there are many rooms, just as in heaven there are many mansions."
Teresa's mother died when she was 13, and after a stormy adolescence, she entered the Carmelite convent of the Incarnation. Teresa was afraid of marriage, and 16th century Spain offered no alternative but the cloister. A life of purgatory, Teresa reasoned, would mean an eternity of joy.
When we think of Teresa today, we tend to visualise the final product, the mystic and the saint. But the young woman who passed through the convent door on that chill November morning in 1536 was a long way from sainthood. For many years, she was unable even to pray, as she herself tells in her life story.
"I suffered great affliction when I tried to pray, for my spirit, instead of being master, was slave. I was unable to shut myself within myself, without at the same time shutting in 1,000 irrelevances. Often I was more taken up with wishing away my hour of prayer and listening whenever the clock struck than in thinking good thoughts. Again and again I would have chosen any severe penance that might be imposed on me rather than have to practice recollection as a preparation to prayer. I found neither joy in God nor satisfaction in the world. When I was caught up in the pleasures of the world, I was unhappy in recalling what I owed to God. When I was with God, I was restless, craving for what the world had to offer. I passed almost 20 years on this storm-tossed sea. But I realized that by this time it was no longer possible to give up prayer. He who desired me for himself held me in his hand. And I realized the greatness of God's compassion for me. For while I was still entangled with the affairs of the world, he gave me the courage to pray."
Teresa spent 26 years in the Incarnation Convent, a hurly-burly of a place, she called it. 150 women lived in this fashionable convent, where the much-mitigated rule allowed nuns to come and go as they chose, where visitors were frequent and gossip was rife. Teresa herself was drawn for a time into the superficial friendships of the convent parlour, but she gradually tired of this shallow kind of life, and at the age of 43, the idea of the reform came to her.
In 1562, Teresa founded the first convent where those so disposed could live according to the primitive rule of the Carmelites, in the spirit of the original hermits of Mount Carmel, consecrated to silence and contemplative prayer. But though she scaled the mystical heights, Teresa was very down to earth in her approach to prayer.
When I see someone trying to work out what kind of prayer they are practicing, and are so engrossed in prayer that they are afraid, apparently, to move an inch or spare a moment's thought for fear they be deprived to the slightest degree of the devotion they are enjoying, I realise how little they know about the road to union with God. They think that this is the whole thing. Well, it isn't. Not at all. What the Lord wants is works. If you see someone sick to whom you can bring help, don't imagine your devotions will suffer. Have compassion. If she is in pain, try to share her pain. If need be, go without food so that she may have yours.
In the 20 years that followed the foundation of the first Reformed convent, until her death in 1582, Teresa was to found 16 more convents. She faced considerable opposition, was denounced from the pulpit, and described as a restless, contumacious, disobedient gadabout. Since she had to make her foundations in person and be on the spot to resolve problems, she was constantly on the move.
And yet this nun, while living a life of exceptional activity, was dedicated to silence and contemplation and became one of the world's greatest mystics. Her writings on prayer have never been surpassed. She was asked to write on prayer for the nuns of her own convent. Like Teresa in her early years as a nun, they found prayer difficult, but she protested.
Why do they want me to write things? Let learned men who have studied do the writing. There are more than enough books written on prayer already. For the love of God, let me work at my spinning wheel and go to choir and perform the duties of the religious life like the other sisters. I am not meant to write. I have neither the health nor the wits for it.
But Teresa did have the wits, and her words were wise and full of common sense.
Why do we use so many words, she said, when the petitions contained in the Our Father cover all our needs, spiritual and temporal? From foolish devotions may God defend us.
Teresa also gives clear directives to those who have to deal with religious of a nervous kind.
Superiors should not, in general, allow nuns who are neurotic to spend long stretches of time at prayer. Usually, the imagination of such persons is their weak point, and too much prayer only does harm. Besides, they get extraordinary ideas which neither they themselves nor others who hear of such goings-on can possibly understand.
Much has been said about St. Teresa's mystical experiences. She herself was frequently embarrassed by them, especially when she had raptures in public. As for their significance, she was categorical and advised others to be wary of mystical phenomena.
Though some such phenomena may be genuine, I'm sure it is best to regard them of no importance. God guides some people in one way, some in another. And this particular path is not the one which leads to the greatest sanctity. Progress in the spiritual life has nothing to do with consolations granted during prayer, nothing to do with raptures, visions, and the like, the value of which we cannot estimate until we reach the world to come.
In her interior castle, Teresa asks her readers, who were her co-sisters, what they think God's will is, and answers that they should be perfect and be one with him. She goes on.
The Lord asks two things of us. Love of God and love of our neighbour. If we want to know whether we are keeping these commandments, we must discover, I believe, whether we genuinely love our neighbour. For we cannot be sure if we are loving God, whereas we can know if we love our neighbour. Ask the Lord to give you this perfect love for others. Allow him to work within you. If you do your best to fulfill this in every way you can, he will give you more than you can desire.
Finally, Teresa suggests that as regards mental prayer, it's a question of a relationship between friends. That is her own experience, and she says, I can speak of what I have experience of.
Mental prayer, in my opinion,
is nothing else than an intimate sharing between friends. It means taking time frequently to be alone with him whom we know loves us. In order that love be true and the friendship endure, the wills of the friends must be in accord. The will of the Lord, it is already known, cannot be at fault. Our will is vicious, sensual, and ungrateful. And if you do not yet love him as he loves you, because you have not reached the degree of conformity with his will, you will endure this pain of spending a long while with one who is so different from you, whose friendship is of such immense benefit, and who loves you so much.
Teresa of Avila died at Alba de Tormes on October the 4th, 1582. She was canonized by Pope Gregory the 15th 40 years later. And on October the 15th, 1967, Pope Paul the 6th declared her a Doctor of the Church.
Teresa's death, this prayer was found in her breviary.
Be thou by naught perturbed, of naught afraid, for all things pass save God, who does not change. Be patient, and at last thou shalt of all fulfillment find. Hold God, and naught shall fail thee, for he alone is all.
And while our thanks there go to Jill Bevilacqua for this beautiful programme, finally let's join our music historian, Monsignor Philip Whitmore, as he brings us music for the second glorious mystery of the Rosary.
Caelos ascendit hodie. Today he ascended into heaven. That uplifting motet for double choir is by Sir Charles Villiers Stanford, a composer little known outside the Anglo-Saxon world, but a towering figure in late Victorian England nevertheless. An Irishman by birth, he became Professor of Music at Cambridge, and he taught for many years at the Royal College of Music in London. As a Protestant, he didn't often have occasion to write Latin motets, but this piece wasn't actually written to be sung in church. It was grace before meals at an Ascension Day banquet in Trinity College, Cambridge. What a marvellous way to begin a festal meal. Caelos ascendit hodie was later published as one of three Latin motets by Stanford, all written in similar circumstances, and now in the repertoire of cathedral choirs. Many of the anthems and motets written for the Feast of the Ascension draw on the text of Psalm 47, O clap your hands. That's because verses 5 and 6 seem particularly appropriate. Was taken from a setting by Orlando Gibbons, who was organist of the Chapel Royal in London in the early 17th century. Now let's listen to a setting of the same words in Latin, written by a contemporary of Gibbons, the composer Peter Phillips, who, like so many English Catholics, had fled to the continent to escape persecution. Thank you. As you can imagine, there's no shortage of fine choral music to celebrate the Feast of the Lord's Ascension. But I'd like to move on now to consider a remarkable piece of 20th century organ music, written as an extended meditation on this same mystery. L'Ascension by Olivier Messiaen was originally written for orchestra in 1933, but transcribed for organ the following year. The third movement, which we're going to hear now, was added in the organ version. It's called Transport de Joie, Joyful Cries of a Soul Beholding the Glory of Christ, which is also its own. Messiaen was a church organist himself at La Trinité in Paris for over 60 years. The French have a fine tradition of liturgical organ music and especially improvisation. It must have been wonderful to hear Messiaen improvising there Sunday after Sunday. The final movement of L'Ascension is called Prière du Christ montant vers son Père, Prayer of Christ ascending towards the Father. Messiaen bases it on a text from St. John's Gospel. Father, I have made your name known to them. Now I am not in the world any longer, but they are in the world, and I am coming to you. Slowly and calmly, the music rises, caught up in rapturous contemplation of this timeless mystery.
And warm thanks there to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian who is currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. And that brings me up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Laudetur Jesus Christus.